From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The head of a Syrian militant group linked to Al-Qaeda and ISIS reportedly had no trouble entering Washington on a European passport. When asked about it Monday, State Department spokesperson Mark Toner refused to discuss what he termed visa records.
Were U.S. officials aware of this visit?
I'm not sure that we were aware of it. I don't believe he had any meetings here, certainly. And I can't speak to visa records. It's privacy considerations, so I don't have much detail I can share with you.
That question was posed by RT's Gayan Shichikayan on Monday. She filed this report.
Ahrar al-Sham's connection to al-Qaeda in Syria is hardly a secret. One of the group's founders, Abu Khalid al-Suri, was a well-known al-Qaeda operative. 2 weeks ago, the group attacked an Alawite village, al-Zara, in Syria. Residents described a massacre. A day before that attack on al-Zara, the U.S., along with Britain and France, blocked Russia's proposal at the U.N. to blacklist this group for its ties with terrorists. Reportedly, Washington still wanted Ahrar al-Sham to be part of the cessation of hostilities agreement. But State Department's Mark Toner said he did not know much about the group and the al-Zara attack.
Does the U.S. apply pressure on Ahrar al-Sham to adhere to cessation of hostilities?
We apply pressure on all members of the credible vetted opposition, and that's part of the HNC.
Do you consider Ahrar al-Sham a vetted opposition group?
Again, we apply pressure on all members of the HNC to adhere to the cessation of hostilities.
2 weeks ago, when they attacked an Alawite village of al-Zara, a photo emerged in social media that showed militants from this group standing above, actually stepping on corpses of several women. The group later said that the women were killed in combat, but they were attacked in their homes. I know you said that you don't know much about Ahrar al-Sham and what they did in al-Zara. I have the photograph that I mentioned. I was reluctant to show it because of how graphic it was, but now I think I will do so. And maybe this will prompt you to look into this group. And I want to ask you, why should this group have protection under the cessation of hostilities when they clearly don't care about cessation of hostilities?
Look, I'm just not aware of this incident. I was not casting doubt or not trying to, I'm just not aware of it.
Separately, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued a statement Monday on the fighting in Syria. He condemned a series of bombings in the coastal cities of Jablay and Tartus, which reportedly killed more than 120 people. ISIS, also known as Daesh, claimed responsibility. The Secretary General urged all sides to the conflict to refrain from attacking civilians and to return to negotiations. Deanne Penn reports.
The UN chief said perpetrators of such attacks must be held accountable for their crimes. Ban Ki-moon also expressed great concern over escalating military activity in many areas in and around the Syrian capital, Damascus. He added that violence is also causing mounting casualties in places such as Daraya, Aleppo, Idlib, and the northern countryside of Homs. Stefan Dujarric is spokesperson for the UN Secretary General.
The Secretary General reminds all parties to the cessation of hostilities of their duty to abide by its terms in accordance with Security Council Resolutions 2268. He calls on all member states to take immediate, collective, and decisive action to bring the tragedy unfolding in Syria to an end in line with their commitments in according with Security Council Resolutions 2254 and 2268.
More than 250,000 people have been killed in Syria since the conflict began in March 2011. It has also generated what the UN says is the largest displacement crisis globally, with nearly 5 million people forced to flee the country and another 6.5 million displaced within its borders. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
But contrary to the call by the UN Secretary General, the targets selected by ISIS were clearly selected to maximize civilian casualties, as Press TV's Mohammed Ali reports from Damascus.
Those who perpetrated the attack are definitely after killing the largest number of civilians possible. This was clear because they chose bus stations and the residential quarters. In Jabliya, for example, four explosions happened, two of them inside the main bus station over there, then followed by a third explosion at the electricity directorate. And the fourth explosion was, according to eyewitnesses there, that the suicide bomber who was wearing the explosive belt pretended to be helping the injured reach the ambulances and then reach the emergency department inside the hospital. He blew himself up inside that department, causing heavy material damage, of course, to the hospital, which came out of service and killing more and more people, civilians. Some of them were even those who were injured in the first blast at the bus station. After that, the three explosions happened in Tartus, two of them in the, bus station also of Tartus, one with a car bomb, the second with an explosive device, and the third was in a residential quarter.
Police used water cannons to disperse anti-austerity protesters in the center of Brussels Tuesday. Those attacks on demonstrators took place after the official demonstration, where an estimated 50,000 people protested against austerity. That demonstration had ended without incident. Meanwhile, in the UK, drivers from private car hire firm Addison Lee protested outside the company's headquarters in Mayfair's Berkeley Square in London Tuesday. Those drivers have seen their earnings continue to plunge due to competition from car-sharing apps such as Uber. President Barack Obama was in Vietnam again Tuesday, and early in the day, he addressed the TPP, the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, with a Vietnamese audience.
What TPP does is it takes 12 countries along the Asia-Pacific region that represent a huge portion of the entire world marketplace. And it says, we're going to create standards for trade and commerce that are fair, that create a level playing field, that have high standards, that encourage rule of law, that encourage protection of intellectual property. So if V or Hong come up with a great idea, somebody's not just going to steal it off the internet, but the work that they put in is protected. That has strong environmental provisions so that countries can't just take advantage of no environmental protection to undercut competitors who are following more responsible environmental practices. And you know, not only do all the countries who are participating stand to gain from increased trade, but Vietnam in particular, I think economists who have studied it believe would be one of the biggest beneficiaries. From the United States perspective, it's a common sense thing to do because, frankly, our markets are already more open than many of the markets of the countries that are signing up. So Japan, for example, is able to sell a lot of cars in the United States, but has a lot of problems importing beef from the United States. And what we've done is to make sure that a lot of the tariffs that are currently being placed on U.S. exports and U.S. goods are reduced. And so it'll create a better environment for U.S. businesses, particularly because of some of the intellectual property protections. A lot of what we sell today are products of our knowledge-based economy. And so it's a smart thing to do across the board. Now, the problem in the United States around trade, and this is not new, this has been true for the last 30 years, is that some of the previous trade agreements did not have enforceable labor protections or environmental protections. I think when China came in to the WTO, it was able to take advantage of the growing global supply chain and a lot of manufacturing shifted to China in a very visible way. So a lot of Americans saw companies close and saw what they viewed as their jobs being exported to China. And some of that happened in Mexico with NAFTA as well. And so the perception was that this is bad for U.S. workers and U.S. jobs. If you look at the data, then what is true is that some manufacturing jobs were lost as a consequence of trade. On the other hand, other sectors of the economy improved significantly. And overall, it was good for the U.S. economy. But I think that in the design of some of the old trade deals and some of the mistakes that may have been made in the past, people became suspicious of trade and worried that if we do TPP, then the same pattern will repeat itself and U.S. will lose more jobs. My argument is that if you're dissatisfied with the current trading arrangements where tariffs are placed on U.S. goods, but other people's goods are already coming into the U.S., why would you want to just maintain the status quo? Why not change it so that everybody's operating in a fair and transparent way? And the good news is that the majority of Americans still believe in trade and still believe that it's good for our economy. The bad news is politics in the United States is not always, how would I put it, reasonable. That's the word I'm looking for. But I'm confident that we're going to be able to get it done because in the past, when we've negotiated trade deals, even though there's a lot of opposition, at the end of the day, we end up getting it done. Keep in mind that we negotiated a very big free trade agreement with Korea. Even though the Bush administration negotiated it, he didn't get it passed. When I came into office, one of the first things we did was we worked with Korea. We made some small modifications to some of the terms, and we got it done. And it's in force today. The argument that I've made, and I will continue to make in the United States, is that we're not going to be able to end globalization. We have to make globalization work for us. And that means that we don't try to put barriers and walls between us and the rest of the world. But instead, we try to make sure that the world has high standards, treats our companies fairly. And if we do that, I'm confident we can compete with anybody.
For more on that, we spoke with analyst Eric Dratzer, who maintains the website stopimperialism.org.
What I find particularly interesting is that Obama's sitting there and talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the importance of free trade, the importance of globalization in a country that is in many ways ground zero for industrial production in textiles and a number of other fields for the purposes of export to the U.S. market. So Vietnam, I think, and the people of Vietnam, particularly the working class in Vietnam, understands perfectly what globalization is about and to a large extent what the Trans-Pacific Partnership is about. But notice that when Obama was speaking in Vietnam and he was talking about support for the TPP, and this was actually noted by the other speakers as well, it is the quote-unquote business community that supports the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It is the, in other words, what we might say is it is the capitalists, it is the owners of capital, the owners of the factories, the owners of large-scale industry. They're the ones who support Trans-Pacific Partnership. It doesn't actually benefit working people. It certainly doesn't benefit the environment. It doesn't benefit global trade in a real sense, only those who are at the top of the food chain. And so Obama's really on a public relations kick rather than really trying to disseminate some grains of truth about this trade deal. And again, we have to keep in mind the sort of the red-colored elephant in the room, and that is China, because really the Trans-Pacific Partnership is not only a quote-unquote free trade deal, it is also an anti-China economic weapon. That's really how it needs to be understood. Obviously, if the United States, the initiator of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, were particularly interested in integration, economic integration, and economic cooperation in the Asia-Pacific, why would it not include China? I mean, it would just be logical. But of course, it does not include China, because China is really the target of this trade deal. And again, we should point out the fact Obama is standing on stage with representatives of some of the largest corporations in the world, like Microsoft, right? These are the forces that are supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it's interesting to note, Don, that in his presentation there on stage, Obama actually made the argument that free trade deals of the past, they were simply not quote-unquote sold correctly to the people, but that actually that they have benefited the American people. Oh, sure, we've lost industrial jobs, wages have stagnated, they've destroyed the agricultural sector in Mexico with NAFTA, they've destroyed the sectors of other countries with other free trade deals. It has globalized and continued the assault on working people. All of that, sure, it's just perception, according to Obama. This is the kind of lies that Obama is really a master at spinning, a master at putting forward. And the fact that there are people in this world who don't see through it to this point, it would be shocking if it weren't so sad.
You know, one of the interesting contradictions in what he said there, if you think about it, he's on the one hand selling TPP to the Vietnamese people. And the way he's selling it, because it really seems directed at Americans in the presidential election, the way he's selling it is saying that, look, you know, right now the conditions are such that you can sell your stuff here, but we can't sell our stuff there. And those are the things that we need to change. This will create American jobs, which, of course, says to the Vietnamese people and cost you Vietnamese jobs. What kind of a sell job is that?
Well, I don't think that Obama particularly cares necessarily, because I think that his focus is on, as he said quite explicitly, the Vietnamese business community, and that what he's really concerned about is not the working people of Vietnam, nor about the working people of the United States. What he's particularly interested in is political power and the ability to sell deals to the American people that they simply don't want. It's very disheartening in a sense to watch a president talk about U.S. politics, quote unquote, as being problematic when it comes to free trade. What he really means is public opinion is problematic. The fact of the matter is American working people don't like free trade. They don't like free trade deals. They want manufacturing jobs. They want industrial output. They want a working class that can support itself and support its families. They don't want increased billions of profits for multinational corporations to move those jobs overseas. This is a fundamental fact. This is why even Obama himself in 2008 in his first campaign on the debate stage with John Edwards and Hillary Clinton and the others who were running for the Democratic nomination at that time, they all had to come out publicly against free trade deals, against NAFTA, against the expansion of free trade. And then, of course, as soon as the election is over, they turn around and support it, become the most vigorous proponents of those very same policies. So, again, this shows sort of the cynicism that really is U.S. politics. In other words, it's really about who can lie to the American people the best, who can make them believe their lies the most effectively, so that once they're in office, they can turn around and do the opposite. That's really what U.S. politics is about.
You know, they tailor the lies, of course, to either perceived public sentiment or actually evident public sentiment. And in the presidential election this year, you see both Trump and Sanders having been lifted up largely on their opposition to these deals and a claim that they, you know, see the need to recover manufacturing jobs here and a plan to do so in one fashion or another. Not that they've offered one, but they're, you know, they're saying that that's what needs to be done. That of course, is because of the widespread opposition to these things, which is something that the parties try to manage, as Obama did. I mean, you heard him just brag about achieving George Bush's trade deal with Korea.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Obama's bragging about it, despite the fact that that's a horrific trade deal that benefits nobody in the working sector. It really benefits billionaires. But besides the point, I want to just highlight, if I could, what you're alluding to with regard to Trump and Sanders. I think that both of them have certainly waxed poetic about the dangers and destructive elements that these free trade deals really have. Though I would be very hesitant to believe anything is genuine that comes out of Trump's mouth, and I don't think that Sanders' positions are really all that relevant, because the Democratic Party has all but locked up its machinery for Hillary Clinton, so I'm not sure that Sanders' position necessarily matters all that much as far as the electoral side of this issue goes. But Trump's obviously does, because Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, and Trump himself has benefited tremendously from free trade. Trump manufactures, you know, a lot of consumer goods that bear his name and bear his logo in China, in Vietnam, in Cambodia, in a lot of these places. So, you know, Trump himself has benefited from it. The thing with Trump is that what he has done effectively, and what he has the way it really is the wave that he has ridden to this Republican nomination, is what should be correctly called right-wing populism. I mean, that's really what he is appealing to, right-wing populist sentiment, and right-wing populist sentiment is against free trade. Okay, those are working people and some poor people living below the poverty line, in fact, who understand on a visceral level the negative ramifications of free trade, that don't want this, and that's really who Trump is appealing to. Now, whether or not he's genuine in actually opposing free trade, I would be much, much more skeptical, and I would certainly venture to guess that Trump, as president, will not be able to, or necessarily even be willing to, reverse the tide of free trade and neoliberal capitalism. I mean, he sits and talks about, you know, implementing tariffs on Chinese goods and, you know, bringing jobs back to the United States, as if one single president alone, who would be opposed by a large segment of the political establishment, would even be able to do that. These are the kinds of populist sentiments that Donald Trump is really trading in. I don't think that we should necessarily see him as the standard bearer of the vanguard of resistance to free trade. Not at all.
No, I don't. What I'm doing basically is holding the candidates out and what they're, you know, regurgitating from the bottom illustrating the depth and breadth of that position among the electorate. Now, you know, on the one hand, yes, depending on what happens in Philadelphia, and it's quite possible that what you said is exactly correct. It certainly seems like they're trying to engineer the outcome and have all hands on deck. But the people behind Sanders, who were polling at 30, 40, 45%, no, we won't vote for Hillary Clinton, a large part of those people are also behind Sanders on this particular issue, and they're going to be in play. Trump will still be arguing it, and Clinton, of course, is stuck with her active support of NAFTA and her positions on free trade generally up until this election. One thing that Trump's candidacy has either revealed, brought to the surface, perhaps even helped actualize, is a reconfiguration of the groupings, the majority grouping inside the Republican Party, away from the religious right to a large degree, to people that are voting over economic issues. You know, he certainly has cobbled together the white supremacists and the anti-immigrants and the Islamophobes and everyone into that. But you have a lot of people who voted in a Republican primary for the first time saying, I don't give a damn what his position is on abortion or gay marriage. He's going to get me a job. And I'm wondering if that sentiment might go outside of the Republican Party and affect some Democrats who otherwise would find most of what he's saying distasteful.
There's no doubt. You're 100% right, Don. That's exactly what's happening. And that phenomenon, that is to say, the move away from these social and cultural wedge issues and towards what, you know, what could be called core economic concerns or the meat and potatoes issues, so to speak. I mean, that is obviously to be welcomed. The issue that I have, the problem that I have, is in this notion that Donald Trump as an individual or as president is going to be able to actually affect any of these things, or really would even be willing to. That's where I'm not, you know, I'm not really willing to buy that.
But at the moment, as huge sectors of people voting on those issues, particularly, again, the core economic issues, have been orbiting both Trump and Sanders. And as the campaign goes forward, of course, Clinton's only defense, if she ends up being the nominee, as seems quite possible, her only, because of her own record, her only real PR attack on Trump saying that is that he doesn't really mean it, and to, you know, to essentially side with the American people in their overall skepticism of the truthfulness of both Trump and generally political candidates for office in the United States. Now, if you have people that are looking to express this and see they can't get it expressed through Clinton and hear Clinton convince them that Trump ain't going to give it to you either, you know, there are these third political parties who suddenly, who have been embracing these positions for a long time, suddenly are the only option for people that are going to vote on this issue. Do you think people have a chance of being driven by their economic needs past that barrier that third parties have been historically here?
I think that in greater numbers than we have seen in many decades, for sure. I think that there's no doubt. I think that Jill Stein and the Green Party will gain significantly. I think that perhaps even some of the smaller socialist parties might gain more, you know, just in terms of protest votes and in terms of disaffected Bernie Sanders voters and the rest of it. I think that that is true. Now, do I think that third parties are going to be somehow, you know, significant or relevant to this election? Not necessarily. I think that even the Green Party itself at the national level has pretty openly expressed that this is all about, you know, efforts to build for the future, and that they're trying to build and ballot access in all 50 states and things like that, which are, of course, important if you're building a political party. There's no doubt about that. But what I do think, though, and this is a question that Bernie Sanders supporters really need to ask themselves, is Bernie Sanders throwing away a potential opportunity to not only make a historic mark on U.S. politics, but to actually potentially even win an election? You know, this is a real question. Now, I don't necessarily believe that he could win it, but it is a real question that people in his camp need to be asking. If you look at the polling numbers, okay, and you look at the disapproval numbers for both Trump and Clinton, they're like historic. They are historic for two candidates running for president. I mean, the majority of the United States dislikes both of those candidates.
I know.
So if you had a situation in which a Bernie Sanders, who already has a, you know, quote unquote movement, to whatever extent it's a movement, coalesced around him, and he were able to mobilize and to join with something like the Green Party in a coalition, they might actually be able to make some real noise nationally, particularly considering how many of the supporters of a Hillary Clinton would actually be peeled away from the Democratic Party in that scenario. But it's not going to happen. Sanders has already put the kibosh on that. He's already said that's not going to happen. He's not willing to do anything that's going to hurt the Democratic Party. In fact, if anything, he's strengthened the Democratic Party. So again, it's sort of, you know, six of one, half dozen of another when you look at exactly how this is all playing out. So that's why I'm somewhat skeptical and not necessarily so high on Sanders himself. But I do think what you're pointing to is important. These economic issues, they're not going anywhere. The economy is not going to improve in the next 4 or 8 years. It's only going to get worse. I think this is almost universally understood. And so where are we going to be 4 years from now, 8 years from now, assuming that the, you know, catastrophic scenarios don't play out, we'll have another election and we'll see exactly what the mood of the country is, because the way that this is going, both parties are being delegitimized.
Eric, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.